Hey, Airspace fans. We are so excited to share this episode with you. We had a great time this past March at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. Now, I had never been to South by Southwest, and I envisioned something pretty busy and bustling, but I was entirely unprepared for what the streets were like. And our stage was between two active bars on either side. So in addition to our full house crowd, you may hear some of that stuff in the background. And now, without further ado, here's the show.
Welcome to Airspace. We are live from South by Southwest. We're here on the We DC stage, courtesy of the Aerospace Industries Association. I'm Emily Martin. I'm a planetary geologist.
I'm Matt Jindal. I'm a space historian.
And I'm Nick Partridge.
And we're all from the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. And later on in our show, we'll be joined by a special guest, Babak Ferdowsi, from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And today, we're talking about failure, that sort of unsung hero of achievement. And we're going to tell stories of a few of our favorite failures. Failures of technology, failures of economy.
Failure to fail.
Is a failure to fail failure or a success? This episode is about failures and how they've inspired so much success in science and in space exploration. That's coming up next from this episode of Airspace from the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum with support from PRX.
So our first chapter of failure actually has to do with the history of supersonic commercial transport.
Has anyone here ever flown on the Concorde? I thought not. And there's a reason behind that. There were 16 made?
There were 16. Technologically, they did just about everything right. They designed a beautiful plane that was able to fly at supersonic speed. It was able to carry 100 passengers within the span of about 3 hours from New York to Paris or New York to London, but it never was able to really achieve great commercial success. The years that it flew, from the mid-70s up until the early 2000s, it cost several thousand dollars to buy a ticket on the Concorde. But when you did, you became part of an elite group. You were given special sort of glitzy gifts, like silver tie clips and unlimited champagne. It was basically 2x2 seating that's not much more roomy than what we think of today as like business class seating.
So first class experience, coach amount of leg room?
Exactly.
So the real experience is when you're back on the
ground. Well, and you also get a certificate at the end saying that you have flown on the Concorde.
That's the mark of an everyday experience for the common Joe. And was it successful?
When they first started designing this plane, they were competing with other subsonic planes that only flew about 80 to 100 passengers. But by the time it went into flight in the mid-70s, we were flying 747s, and you could fly 400 to 450 passengers on the same amount of fuel from New York to Paris.
Prohibitively expensive.
Yes.
Didn't fly very many routes.
Right.
And probably not popular on the ground for people with the sonic booms.
Yes, because it flies so fast, it creates a sonic boom that can be heard on the ground and that could potentially damage property. So in the United States in the 1970s, Congress actually banned having the Concorde fly over land. That's why it was only really ever used for transatlantic flight.
There was only two airlines that actually had the Concorde.
British Air and Air France were the two main partners. So then another problem that it had was because it flew so high, it was essentially flying in the bottom of the ozone layer. And so there were worries that it could actually potentially damage the ozone layer by introducing nitrogen oxides there into the ozone layer, which could then react and lead to degradation of the ozone layer.
But there's a little bit of a silver lining here.
There is a silver lining. So because they never flew a huge fleet of supersonic transport jets, it didn't really pose the problem to the ozone that they figured it would. But because it raised awareness of the vulnerability of the ozone layer, it actually led kind of indirectly to the discovery that there was, in fact, an ozone hole.
So there's a couple of sort of bus stops in between it, but essentially flying the Concorde led us to the discovery of the hole in the ozone.
In an indirect way, yes. So I think the takeaway of this story really is that technological development doesn't happen in a vacuum. Whether you succeed or you fail, there are economic and social factors that you really have to take into account in order for a thing to really work. You can get everything right technologically and still have missed some big factor that's going to lead you to fail economically.
Have you guys ever broken down on the side of the road?
Who hasn't?
Of night?
I mean, who hasn't, really?
Very frustrating. I have never felt more capable than having a tire blow out at 80 miles an hour in a 1992 Toyota Tercel and steering it safely to the side of the road. But then I don't fly spaceships, so that's a really low bar.
Yeah. Well, I think even worse than being broken down by the side of the road with a blown tire or whatever inconceivable engine problem you might be having is when you're a kid and you break down with your dad. And that's the moment in a lot of kids' lives, I think, when they realize their dad can't solve every problem, right? He can't just MacGyver his way through a big engine failure.
It's those moments, I think, when we all wish that we had America's dad, Tom Hanks.
Hey, kids!
To help you through it. He's got such a calming aura about him, even in the most upsetting moments, like being stuck in a broken spaceship en route to the moon, as we all saw on Apollo 13.
This is the crew of the Apollo 13, wishing everyone back on Earth a pleasant evening.
On April 13th, 1970, about 56 hours into the mission, about 205,000 miles from Earth, and only 6 minutes after they turned off a live TV camera, there was a loud bang from inside the spacecraft, and the spacecraft starts spinning, all the power goes out, and I cannot stress how upsetting this would be looking out the window and seeing all of your oxygen venting into deep space. So that's where they're at, that's the baseline. And Jim Lovell, played by Tom Hanks, says the most famous line in the movie, which is, say it with me, Houston. Funny story, that's actually slightly incorrect. What he said was,
he
Houston, we've had a problem, because test pilots always spoke in a very passive voice to maintain detachment. It just makes for terrible screenwriting, so they altered it a little bit. So we've got this spinning spacecraft. It's in a perilous place, miles beyond reach of people from Earth. How did NASA arrive at a place where they were able to deal with this catastrophic failure? Luckily for the crew of Apollo 13, some of the ultimate preppers in human history worked at NASA in the 1970s. And from the very beginning, NASA simulated every possible thing that could happen when flying a lunar mission, especially thousands of different failure scenarios.
Really? Thousands?
Thousands. Thousands. Oh, thousands.
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 That's a
so,
lot.
There's the ones that you saw in the movie.
Sure.
Using the lunar module as a lifeboat.
Right.
Firing the engines out of sequence.
Four.
How long does it go?
Two.
Taking all of the navigation data from one computer and plugging them into another computer. Do you remember the square peg round hole problem?
Those CO2 levels are going to be getting toxic.
Well, I suggest you gentlemen invent a way to put a square peg in a round hole. Rapidly.
That was something that they had prepared.
Wait, was that
for?
When they like dumped the box of stuff on the table?
Yes.
Yeah, love that part.
Precisely. Yeah.
Make it fit.
So all of those scenarios, but also much more. The simulators practiced what to do if there was a political crisis that might actually impact the mission. They practiced what happens if a mission controller has a heart attack. There are stories of instructors sneaking in with a sheet of paper to a mission controller, and he opens it up and it says, "You're having a heart attack." And the acting was so great, they called 911. Really upset the paramedics. All the way to what happens if an astronaut gets measles, which you may remember is actually something that happened.
I just got some blood work back from the lab. Charlie Duke has the measles.
Something else they prepared for? An astronaut forgetting to file his taxes. Remember, this happened on April 13th. For anyone wondering, you get an automatic extension. So by the middle of the crisis, the mission controllers have been through thousands of simulations. The astronauts have been through thousands of simulations. They've worked out a plan to get through this. Better planning was the foundation of the failure is not an option culture at NASA. And at one point, a mission controller radioed up to Apollo 13, "How do you like this sim?" And Jim Lovell, ever the Boy Scout, restrained himself and only said, "It's a beaut." Right. Understatement.
We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll talk more about the culture of failure and why it's actually a great thing.
The Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, is the home to many of the marquee missions of deep space robotic exploration, and they have to balance the idea of failure is not an option, which is the culture within NASA, with a tagline, dare mighty things. Here to help us discuss how that balances between historic NASA and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory is Babak Ferdowsi. He is internet famous, of course, from his, internet famous from Curiosity, but also had roles on Cassini and Europa Clipper, and you are now a fault protection engineer at JPL.
Yes, that's right.
Do you quote Apollo 13, either the movie or the actual mission?
I mean, I draw a lot of inspiration from Tom Hanks in general, so that's...
Don't we all?
Yeah.
What is a fault protection engineer?
I mean, we've had a number of failures, of course, in our missions, and that's how I kind of learned that this was an area that people could study. Working on Curiosity, we had what we call anomalies, because we typically try to state things in either it's nominal and it's going fine, or it's anomalous and it's not, and it covers all manner of sin. So anomalies, including we had a computer reset 3 days after launch as we are preparing to do our first burn to get to Mars. And that's really where, you know, I learned about it sort of as we got to design a system, but that's the first time I really had to encounter it personally. And so I typically describe my job as understanding those possible scenarios in advance and trying to design a system that prevents or tolerates some of those as necessary.
Are there any particular, let's say, like Mars mission failures that you sort of use as studies, case studies for preparing for possible failures?
When you really understand how things break, that's when you actually truly know how they work, right? I mean, it's that childhood sense of trying to take things apart to understand how they work. That ultimate test of, I know the theory of how to change a tire, or I got to change the tire on that broken car.
Yeah.
And so Mars Observer is this mission that we thought we were very clever. We said, oh, we've got these amazing Earth satellites. They operate for years. Let's take one of those. We'll send it to Mars. And then we'll do Mars, and it'll be cheap. It'll be fantastic. And what they did was, right before they got into Mars orbit, because of the way they tested, they turned off the radios and prepared for this big maneuver. And then we just never heard from it again because we turned off the radio. And it seems so obvious in retrospect that you should communicate with the Earth, particularly when you're doing something of interest. And then, again, if you do make a mistake, at least get the knowledge out of that mistake to not do it again.
Yeah.
What's the most redundant element of a rover? Like, what's the system that you can plug in 1,000 different ways just in case?
I mean, Curiosity is a great example. Missions like Cassini are what we call our flagship missions, are where we often, and of course, human spaceflight has even more of this redundancy. To the point where, initially when they did Shuttle, they had independent teams code software for Shuttle so that even if you made an error in your code, that another team should in theory not make the same coding error. And that is a level that we don't do with Curiosity, although we do have two versions of software always, one that's the latest version and one's the previous version. We can lose a computer effectively, or at least parts of it, have another computer come online and start poking at it and be like, what happened? Send me your last bits of data. Let me understand why that computer failed.
Is that the equivalent of changing a tire on Mars?
It's like the equivalent of having a spare tire, right, effectively, right, which is this backup computer. But also, it gives us a way of understanding what the failure of the first tire was, right? And so that once we have the new tire on, we can say, oh, listen, you're going to have to change the way you drive so that you don't get another blown tire. And in the meantime, you know, drive cautiously on the donut.
I've been thinking about in my brain the Mars exploration rovers, which were really only supposed to be on doing their science for what, like 90 days, 60 days, something like that. It was an incredibly short mission, and we just lost opportunity after, what, 15 years of service. And I'm curious about how the aging of these space robots helps inform your ability to mitigate unexpected failures, right? With an aging spacecraft, things are gonna fail because it wasn't meant to last 15 years. It's incredible that it did. So is there a way in which how sort of those rovers aged and bits started to fail that help inform sort of the future of those kind of exploration?
Yeah, I mean, at various levels, because obviously with the you know, the great thing about the Mars program is we can have lots of missions, and Curiosity's development started even before Opportunity and Spirit had landed. So you can't learn everything possible from them. But we definitely learn a lot, both from the successes and the failures. So, you know, Opportunity and Spirit demonstrated kind of some of the first levels of self-driving, autonomy in the driving. Curiosity benefited from that. In the case, as they age, you know, Opportunity also had some, at the kind of near its Alzheimer's, where it could not store everything, and every day you had to load from memory various parameters, and like, so as you woke it up, you were like, hey, remember all these things that you were supposed to be doing. And it's a pretty amazing, you know, and it really speaks to the resourcefulness of the team.
So 90 days versus 15 years. How, when you launch a new spacecraft, you put a new robot on a new planet, what's the expectation that it could exceed the advertised life expectancy of a 90-day mission?
I think we always expect it to exceed that. I mean, we, and part of this robustness, part of this, you know, preventing failures is we test components to 3 times life often. So, you know, every motor gets operated, if it's 2 years for Curiosity, gets operated for effectively 6 years of life and seeing how it does. You know, you want to make sure that it's not a statistical anomaly, that the one thing that you tested and it dies after 2.5 years, you're like, oh, that's good enough to meet the 2 years. Well, what if that was the high end? So you test it for 6 years and prove that if it makes it all the way there and you do a few of them, it's going to work. And it's kind of the warranty, right? It's like you want to make sure you have a good enough product that half of them aren't going to fail before the warranty expires.
So in the event of premature failure, would you guys fly the Maytag man up there?
That's right. Yeah.
Change out
personal
the
friend. I mean, we got him on speed dial.
Yeah.
So on that note, can I give a little shout out to like the engineering models and the test vehicles that actually are responsible for doing a lot of that testing on Earth?
Disclaimer, I mean, they're all in his collection.
They are what I collect for the museum, and I love them, and I want you all to appreciate that they're not just the best possible representation that's not the spacecraft. They're actually mission critical, right?
A plug for his pet robots.
You know, we fail early in the test program in order so that we don't fail in the flight program, and that's where these units come in handy, you know.
What is NASA's reaction as an agency to an individual failure, and how do they prepare you for it?
So, I mean, we talk, you know, we have the old hands who come and give you the war stories of like, oh, what it was like to be on a Mars Observer, of course, and it's very hard. I have not been through a mission that has truly failed in the sense of we lost it. So part of me is like, I want to have that experience so that I'm prepared for it. Part of me is like, well, you know, or I could just succeed all the time. That would be great too. But I think in terms of preparation, you know, again, talk about the gremlins, for example. I say the word gremlins. But you're talking about giving people the thing, a heart attack, so, you know, during the dress rehearsals. We do that, right? We call it that team gremlins, the folks who kind of give you the failures and they inject the failures. So we test the human element of our operating our spacecraft as well as the technical element of it. And so I was called red carded. So during the middle of one of our tests, I was asked to go home with, food poisoning and had to leave the room for about 2 hours so that everybody could prove that they know who to contact in case I wasn't available, make sure that, you know, the replacement person could come in, things like that. And, you know, mid-activity. So we are testing that human element as well. As someone who actually has sent the wrong command to a spacecraft, which is a relatively embarrassing thing to do. Luckily, it cost us no more than a day. We basically, the command failed, fortunately. We also design our system so that a human operator cannot, generally speaking, cannot easily do something bad on a spacecraft and ruin it. Now, we have had issues, of course, with older spacecraft. As teams age out, as a mission lasts for 10, 12 years, that a new team, right, like a fresh out of college person, doesn't know all the little, like, tricks and like, oh, don't do this after this or kind of stuff. And sometimes we have had issues with that. But again, we try to build into the system the possibility of a human failure, a very likely, actually, case of a human failure where, like in my case, where I sent the wrong command one time. But luckily, it was ignored.
Well, and I would imagine that on some of these missions where you have the nominal 90-day start, you know, people are working around the clock, and it's probably pretty easy to make a mistake in that environment.
It really is. And I mean, and to the you know, the contrary, one of the things that helped Opportunity last so long was a very dedicated team who really understood that rover and spent their every day thinking about how that rover works and what would say. And they, I mean, they put in an extreme effort to try to rescue it after the dust storm on Mars. But that is another case of where, you know, investing in the team is a big part of investing in the success and avoiding failure.
It must be really difficult to encounter failure on your own and then try to extract all the lessons from it. Is it important that everyone have the same lesson from a single failure?
I think it's, we try to do that, right? We have a team assemble after every failure to understand what the failure was and particularly understand what the lesson learned was. But I mean, my experience has certainly been, you don't always learn the same lesson. You know, if I have a bicycle accident, my inclination is like, I'm going to get back on my bike, but maybe I'm going to be a little bit more aware that I come to a complete stop at a stop sign or wear a helmet while I'm doing it. And other people might be like, you know what, peace, I'm done with bicycling. I'm going to start driving cars instead. And so it is interesting to see that I think what we're trying to do, and for the most part I've been very successful at NASA, is really get at the core of what caused that failure, right? The grassroots thing. So talk about a failure of a part, a computer, for example. We don't always say, well, we got to have two of those. And then the next time another part fails, oh, put two of those. Instead, we say, well, parts can fail. So let's look across the board. Which parts are more likely to fail? Let's strategically choose the ones that need redundancy. We're good.
Babak Ferdowsi. That's it for this episode of Airspace Live from South by Southwest. Follow us on Instagram at Airspace Podcast. All photos curated here by Emily.
Airspace is produced by Katie Moyer, Jocelyn Frank, Lizzie Peabody, and mixed by Tarek Fuda.
This episode was supported by PRX.
Special thanks to the Aerospace Industries Association, WeDC, South by Southwest, Jason Orfanon, and Genevieve Sponsler, and John Barth.